and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're taking a look into Alaska's fiscal options by looking at facts, frequently discussed approaches, and the dollars attached to the state's very real budget issues. This event was hosted by Alaska Common Ground on October 5th at 49th State Brewing Company. During the first part of the show, we will hear from Alaska Common Ground Chair Cliff Groh, who moderated a discussion between Assistant Professor of Economics Musin Gutabi and former Alaska Deputy Commissioner of Revenue Larry Persily. Later in the program, we'll listen to a panel discussion on the goals and values that are at play when trying to decide Alaska's future. This is an edited version of the event. In order to hear the full audio, you can visit alaskapublic.org. We now go to Cliff Groh.
So we're going to start out here with you, Musin Gutabi.
That's why you invited me?
Musin, why are we here? What is the problem? Why can't we keep doing what we're doing?
I think it's best to think about it as an oil price story, right, that's gotten us here. As of 2013, we had close to $7 billion in unrestricted general fund revenues. About $6 billion of that was coming from petroleum revenues, right? And so fast forward a few years, we have close to $1.8 billion in revenues, 1.1 of which is coming from petroleum. I'm going to throw a lot of numbers at you, and so I apologize in advance, but we were asked to kind of set the stage. And I think that the best way to think about this is to think about that precipitous decline in revenues while we basically have the same population, we're still trying to provide the same kinds of services.
Aren't there a couple other parts too? Haven't we lost about 3/4 of our Alaska oil production since the late 1980s?
Of course. I mean, that predates this most recent decline in prices. But even if we're to actually narrow the window and just look at it from 2013 onwards, we're still looking at a very, very significant loss in revenues. And so you obviously have a deficit that's become structural if we believe the forecasts of oil prices, which say that they're going to hover around $50 going forward.
So, as Professor Gamblers would say, a job I've actually never had, they talk about making the nut. And seeing if we're not making the nut on oil anymore,
yep,
how are we doing this?
Well, savings. We've been basically drawing down on savings. You can think about Alaska's money as basically being in three major pots. There's oil revenues, which, as we've just explained, have declined very fast. We had money in the Constitutional Budget Reserve, our savings account, and then we have the permanent fund, which we'll talk about a little bit later. Constitutional Budget Reserves had close to $15 billion. It's been basically depleted as of yesterday. It has about $3.5 billion, which means that it basically has one more round of spending in it, given that, give or take a few millions, the actual deficit is somewhere around $3 billion. So realistically, we have at best a year left to think about some sort of permanent solution before digging into the permanent fund.
When you say a year, you mean like a calendar year?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound so great, Musin. Maybe we can get something more
cheerful.
Can I
say something?
Sure.
Rosy or no? Okay.
Well, that's not on the script.
I apologize. Well,
Rosy. What is the rosiest thing you'd say?
$61 billion in the permanent fund. Not all of it spendable.
Right.
$13 billion in the earnings reserve, two of which already committed. So that leaves us with maybe $11 billion.
Okay, but a lot of people say that's not the right way to go. And I want to ask you, Larry, because a lot of people say the way for Alaska to solve its fiscal problems is just to wait. It's sort of like being on vacation in a sunny place and you let the tan roll over you in the sun, you wait for high oil prices to go up. Mussin said the first big problem was low oil prices. We just wait for oil prices to go up, problem solved. What's wrong with that, Larry?
For 25 years I've been doing this question in terms of prices. Why don't we wait? Prices could double tomorrow. They'd have to double tomorrow and stay there for eternity until the meteor hits the Earth. And that's not going to happen.
Bummer.
It just isn't. There's too much oil in the world. No one is going to pay $110 oil when they can find it somewhere else for $50.
But I read about, hey, this field might bring in 50,000 barrels a day, or this field might bring in 100,000 barrels a day. Wouldn't that save us?
Alaska is a blemish. We're less than 1% of world oil production. So what if there's 50,000 barrels? It's a blip in the world. It's less than a 10% boost to current production. And you need new oil every year just to replace what you're losing. So you've got to double it, the price, or you're going to have to more than double production. It's just not mathematically plausible.
Okay. Mussin, Larry's bringing me down. I want you to bring me up because I keep hearing. I've read stuff in the newspaper. I've heard stuff on the radio. I've actually been doing this for decades. I've heard about it for decades. ANWR, on NPRA, some specific provinces in Alaska up on the North Slope where there's a lot of people think there's a whole bunch of oil there. And even recently as today, I heard on the radio talk of opening up ANWR. Wouldn't that save us, Mussin?
Well, you've said that you've been here for decades, doing this for decades. The notion of ANWR or NPRA saving us comes with a lot of ifs and buts because there is tremendous amount of uncertainty about how much oil is actually there, how much of it is recoverable, what's the investment that would be necessary to recover it, whether or not the royalty sharing from the federal government would change. And it's not immediate, right? And so there has been an announcement by the federal government that they're putting in $2 billion in the federal budget from lease sales and from ANWR. I don't know the likelihood of that happening. The reality is that none of that happens before we exhaust the CBR. And there is, like I said, considerable uncertainty about how much there is there, how much the state would get from there. And so it's not a realistic option to build on, especially given that we're facing this decline in savings that's not going to go anywhere. So
Wait a minute. If ANWR is not going to save us in the short run, and NPRA won't save us in the short run, a question just asked. What about the gas line, also known as AKLNG, monetization of the North Slope reserves or commercialization?
So I'll tell you what I told the Soldotna Chamber of Commerce recently, which I sort of got in a little trouble. Someone said, is the gas line coming? I said, you know, the Cubs just won the World Series. You get one miracle a decade. So, and look, even if the market changes and the state and the companies get their acts together and begin working together, it's a decade. As he said, we're out of the budget reserve savings next year. So you want to think about something 10 years from now, that's great. How are you going to pay the bills till then?
Some people wonder, Larry, whether the gas line can save us in 10 years.
No.
Okay.
No.
A right.
Billion and a quarter to the state general fund treasury from a gas line by my estimates, which is great. That helps, but that is not the miracle cure.
What's the hole, Mussin? If a billion or a billion and a quarter is not
so, so we can quibble about the exact amount of the hole, but if we just if we use very realistic numbers, we come up with basically the operational budget is close to $4.5 billion for this upcoming year because there were some one-time funds that were used. $4.5 billion, and you have to have some sort of spending for capital budget. For it to be sustainable, you've got to think $200, $250 million. And so we have $1.8 billion in revenues. And so under the most conservative estimates, it's about $2.9 billion that's the deficit. And I'm not talking, and I'm not even including the dividend in the conversation. And so
wait a minute. The deficit is more than half of the budget?
the deficit indeed, and the deficit is bigger than the non-formula agency spending.
That's where they get to the part where you could lay off every state employee and still have a deficit?
That would be correct.
Okay, all right. Larry, you know, that sounds bad, but Larry, other people have an idea. And before we get to that idea, I want to go back to Yuma Sinan on another one that people talk about oil. They say, we'll just raise oil taxes. Some people say, we just can, you know, raise oil taxes. And I want to say full disclosure that along with being the principal legislative assistant when the Permanent Fund Dividend was created, I also was involved in a big oil tax increase back in 1889. Both of those accomplishments were back in the 80s. Some people would say that today is different. But how come we just can't increase oil taxes enough to save us? What's wrong with that plan?
Well, it's not realistic. I mean, again, we're talking about scale of magnitude. And as Larry pointed out, it's $3 billion. You can potentially raise oil taxes. HB 111, I think best estimates saves or gives the state $200 million over 3 years. There was an estimate a few years ago by the Department of Revenue showing that even if you were to raise the minimum tax to 10%, you raise, which is incredibly aggressive, you raise $500 million. So, I mean, again, we're not talking about a solution that comes from one particular place, not even oil taxes, at least not as far as I'm concerned.
Is one of the problems with raising a lot of money from oil taxes now, it's what you talked about earlier, about there being a lot lower oil price and a lot less oil going through the pipeline?
It's a lot lower oil prices. We're not talking about what will the response be from the oil companies if taxes were to be increased. Will that result in even less production? And so there are quite a few consequences to raising taxes. And even if there were to be no response on the production side, you would still not raise enough money from that source alone to close the budget gap.
Wait a minute. So the budget gap you're saying you call over $2.5 billion,
yeah,
closer to $3 billion a
yes,
year,
yes.
And you talked about it as structural, sort of going on and on and on for years and years.
It's structural because the reality is that we've identified these sources of revenues that we currently have. We have this set of spending that we've been declining, by the way. And so, I mean, when you look at, for example, just non-formula government expenditures, they've gone down by about 22% or so from 2015 to fiscal year 2018. And so it's structural because there is absolutely no way around it, right? And so I don't see government spending going back down to, or going down to $1.8 billion. It's just not realistic.
Wait, the budget's falling. I've also heard the budget has fallen more than 40% in the last 5 years on one calculation.
It depends what you include.
Right.
But, yeah.
Okay, but it's
capital spending, for example, has declined by 80%.
Okay. Well, there's a bunch of Alaskans who would like the budget to fall even faster and farther and harder.
Sure.
And they think that the entire fiscal problems of the state, whatever they are, could be solved through budget cuts alone. One radio talk show host told me a few years ago, he said, Cliff, just give me 5 minutes alone with that budget. And so that was his proposed response. And I think there are other Alaskans who think like that, we've seen.
Sure.
What do you think about that? Could the state budget cut be cut enough to solve the state's fiscal problems by itself?
Absolutely not. I mean,
Why do you say that? There
is absolutely no way you can solve a $3 billion budget deficit by reducing, for example, state or agency operations that are right now are at a little bit less than $2 billion. So again, coming back to your previous point, you could lay off every single state worker and you're still not actually filling the budget gap. And so, that does not get you where you wanna go. And obviously, it has long-term consequences. I mean, we're entertaining the question because it's a question, but it's not realistic.
A lot of Alaskans ask this. As a matter of fact, just this year.
So what?
Well, Larry, why don't you say, you've been around a lot of budgets. What do you say about that?
If you wait for a permission slip from every Alaskan who has their head full of stupid facts they've heard on talk radio, we'll never solve this.
Well, I try to reach out to everybody, Larry,
so,
like
yeah,
you.
Yeah, they ask questions, but that doesn't mean it's worthy of an answer because there is no answer.
Don't make me
you
follow
can close,
that one, please.
You want to close the prison in the Matsu and let everyone out? That's fine with me. I don't live in the Matsu.
Okay, an aggressive plan there. Okay, so...
well, I'm just trying to liven it up, Cliff.
Okay. I like it.
Please explain your vehemence, Mr. Persily.
Explain my what?
Elaborate on why you perceive that you think that the state could not solve its fiscal problems by cutting...
Well, you could. Budget. You could close prisons. You could have even less public safety. You know, right now, travel the Seward and Sterling highways at your own risk because of cutbacks with troopers, and I won't even get to the fact that there really is no ambulance coverage. So, yeah, if you want to race to the bottom of 50 states, sure, you can close prisons. You can close the vocational center in Seward. You can shut down job service centers, though that's mostly federal money. But what do you accomplish? You have a state few people want to live in.
Okay.
And that's not a worthy goal.
So we're going to have a brief breakdown, have the first panel come up, have a round of applause for Larry Persily and Maxine Gattaz.
This is 91.1 FM KSKA Anchorage. We just heard from Cliff Groh, who moderated a discussion between Assistant Professor of Economics Musin Gutabi and former Alaska Deputy Commissioner of Revenue Larry Persily. We are moving on to the next part of the program, featuring a panel comprised of former legislators, business owners, and authors. We'll hear from Andrew Helcrow, Charles Woolforth, Rick Helford, Kathy Wasserman, and Thea Agnew-Bembin. This portion of the show was moderated by John Parsi.
All right. Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Andrew Helcrow, and I have been doing these forums for 18 years. Every year, for 18 years, I have been sitting on a panel like this with many of these same people talking about the same thing. And I think the first one with Cliff I did about 15 years ago. Many of the people in this room that are here tonight, Larry Persily, Kathy Wasserman, Senator Rick Halford, have been on these same panels. I mean, Rick started talking about this in the mid-80s during the oil crash. And ladies and gentlemen, let me paint you a visual. I want you to think of your favorite store. I don't care where it is, what it is, your favorite store. And I want you to think about the owner coming up to you and saying, you go through this store and you get whatever you want for free. And you do it. And at the door, he stops you and hands you $1,000 and said, have a fabulous day. Because that, ladies and gentlemen, is what living in Alaska is. You don't pay for roads. You don't pay for courts. You don't pay for corrections. You don't pay for the university. It's a unified system. That's why the state of Alaska spends more per capita than any state in the country. It is responsible for more than any state in the country. Not to mention, it's spread out over God's green earth. The solution 18 years ago is the same as the solution today. This is a structural problem. It's not like the state of Alaska is having a bad week or a bad month and we'll make it up. This is a structural problem. And for any of you out there in the audience who's an engineer or understands structure, you know that you don't fix a broken structure by putting wallpaper over it. Four things. The state needs a broad-based tax. Jay Hammond said it best. Everybody that moves to Alaska costs this state money. You need to use permanent fund earnings because there's no way a broad-based tax will generate enough revenue without crippling the economy. The third thing is you have to grow your resources. We're a resource development state. We need to be more aggressive with mining and fishing and oil development. And the fourth thing is we need to manage government better. For God's sake, 16 years ago, I sat on the floor of the House of Representatives and debated for 8 hours the fact that if we didn't do something then, in 15 years, the options would be far worse. And here we are 15 years later. Spending twice as much, pumping half as much oil. The day does not get any brighter until we start managing government better. You think about SB 91. Do you understand the entire purpose for SB 91 was to save money on courts and corrections? 18 years. It's a long time to be having the same conversation when the solution has always been the same.
I'm Charles Woolforth. I'm a columnist and a writer, and I've been writing about this topic for a long time. And we were asked to talk about, the ethical of the connections of this topic to sort of everyday life. And I've thought about, you know, the where the money has come from that we've been using for so long. We had this enormous discovery of oil, and it made at one time Alaskans the richest people on Earth. Per capita, more money was coming out of those oil wells per Alaskan than even Kuwait or anywhere else on Earth. And what was the effect of that? Well, what we did was we induced creation of a much larger population, much larger society than Alaska, than was sustainable. I mean, if we really wanted, like, what would be the solution to it? How could we have avoided this? If Prudhoe Bay had been about a third as large as it is, we'd be in so much better off position now. Because what's happened is we've created a population, you know, a healthcare system. Everything we've got here is too large, and the reason for that, I guess, is because there's been no connection between the people who are sort of living on that money and the society we have. And I'm not talking about state government. I mean, that's certainly part of it. I'm talking about our economy. You know, all the nice restaurants we have, all the good things we have, all the people who are here. We can't support them anymore in that fashion. And the reason is because, as we've heard, all that money was coming in. So I wish Prudhoe Bay were smaller. Other people wish the oil lasted longer. So we have an opposite point of view on that. The other thing is a lot of people say, well, they wish the permanent fund was larger so that we could just take income off the permanent fund. We wouldn't have to pay any taxes and everything would be easier. I don't wish that at all. You know, I went to a college where there were a lot of rich kids who lived on trust funds, and they never really had to do anything, right? They never knew they were never going to have to earn a dollar because they had a trust fund. And that created a kind of person who was really miserable. You know, it's ironic, but I think one of the things that's basic about human nature is we need to feel a sense of purpose. We need to feel like we have some linkage to our sustenance and our survival. So I actually think it's a good thing that we're going to have to start to pay taxes. I mean, it's a linkage that Larry personally talked about, that yes, you pay for what you get, and you don't have a zero-sum game, and so growth means more money coming in, but it also means that we start to have a connection between our society, the people who are here, and our economy, and how we support it. So I'm fine with actually the budget deficit we have. I think we can cover it if we decide that we're going to belly up to the bar and do it. And I think it's going to make us a better Alaska. I think we're going to have better legislators. I think we're going to be more serious about the decisions we make. And in the long run, really, that's the only way we can survive.
So we are the most spoiled group in the country, in all the states, maybe on the planet. But we did do one thing different that's been held up as an example of the right way to go all the way to the World Bank. And we have a resource available to us that is bar none. No comparison, no state has the kind of money that we have in the bank today. We have 4 years of time to do things and do them right. But what do? The answers should be judged on whether they're progressive or regressive, whether they're pro-Alaskan or anti-Alaskan, whether they work. And above all, if we're going to try and face the changes that we see coming, government is going to have to be trusted with a different level of trust than we've seen in recent years. And it's too bad, but the fact is that, you know, people look at their dividend or their permanent fund and they look at the worst example of state spending, not the best example of state spending. And there are examples both ways. But the system is going to change. There's no question about that. We have more resources per capita than anybody else in the country, in the bank, in the ground, and in our population. We have a very bright future, and to think otherwise is a disgrace to the legacies that brought us here. We have incredible opportunities in front of us. You know, I sit here and I look at Clem Tillion in his 90s, still actively involved in the defense of the things that he worked on. And that's the kind of dedication that we have and we should be very, very grateful for.
In my job as the director of the Alaska Municipal League, I represent all 164 cities and boroughs across the state. And as Andrew said, in the last 32 years, I've watched the state go up and down with reasons that we can and cannot help municipalities do what they do. Back in the 70s, when oil was going well, the state actually went out into the bush to small communities and said, hey, we've got a deal for you. You become a city, and we're going to help you. We'll get you a post office. We'll get you a school. You'll get revenue sharing. Life will be great. So many of them signed up, and that went along for a while, and then things started getting pulled back. Well, those communities, especially out in the rural communities, still have those services that they have to provide and still have onerous permitting things with EPA and their water and many other issues that they have to face and they have to pay for, but there is no longer the same amount of money coming from the state. A lot of cost shifting has been passed over to those communities. Their costs have risen. They've got retirement PERS costs that are high, fuel costs that are high, insurance costs that are high, things that they can no longer take care of. And so as far as the municipalities are concerned, we do need some sort of a broad-based tax. We have discussed this a bit, we liken this to what we would do with our family. If you were low on funds, you would cut to a certain point. But when it comes to the point where it no longer is efficient or effective, or you start to hurt some of those people who need to have a halfway decent lifestyle, then you need to go out and get a second job or get increased revenue. And as far as we're concerned at the Alaska Municipal League, we need some increased revenue. Sales tax, we've always said, is not our favorite, but we are not saying we would up and say no. That's because most of the municipalities in the state already have a sales tax. Many of them, the bush communities, who have no property tax base with which to have a property tax. And when I hear some of the people in power say, well, we don't want to tax the people of Alaska, we indeed are going to have to tax the people of Alaska. And I'm not sure whether they don't want to tax the people of Alaska or whether they just don't want to do it, but they're willing for us to do it. Larry personally sent out a very informal email to some of our communities and said, how many of you are facing an increase in tax? And we got back a pretty good length of communities that are going to have to increase taxes to plow their streets, to plow their boardwalks, to keep their water and sewer going, to keep their elections going, to keep their city halls open, just basic services that are required and desired by their residents. So again, as far as we're concerned, there has to be some sort of broad-based tax in order to provide these services.
Hi everyone, my name's Thea Agnew-Benben, and I'll just lay it down since everyone's giving their pedigrees. So I'm 44 years old, and I moved here with my family in 1973. So when I think about my life here, I've basically benefited from a sustained economic boom that was fueled purely by the oil industry. And I think, as I think about over my life and what that investment from that boom has allowed us to do here, we've really diversified our economy. I mean, we're in a recession right now, but it's very different than when we had one in the 80s. So we've diversified, we've invested in our schools and education. I consider myself a product of that. And now people like me who grew up here are owning businesses, which I do, and have 20 employees. And my husband grew up here too and is now a doctor serving Alaskans. So when I think about this question, I think, what do we want to do in terms of investments for the next generation? So for our kids who are growing up here right now. So the two goals that I think are the most important, the first is really providing a stable base for economic investment and business development. And I can just tell you, I mean, we are a small business, but we probably for the past 4 years have intentionally not hired people. We haven't decided to move to a bigger office. We haven't made any risky moves. Because every year when I'm looking at my budget, I think next year could be the time when the whole thing falls apart. So that's where we've been, and we're tiny. I'm sure much bigger businesses are making the same calculations. So we need to have some kind of stability so that people can invest and think ahead. The second thing is we have to make sure that Alaskans can really provide for their family's basic needs and really pursue a high quality of life, not just to sort of kind of suffering through it, but we want people here to be able to really live. And I think our quality of life here is amazing. And I think we need to ensure that families have the basics, that they can get affordable health care for their families, that they can access education, that they have adequate housing and public safety. So to do those things, I agree with everyone here, a broad-based tax is necessary. I heard the governor's proposal. The only thing I don't like is there's a cap for higher earners. So to me, that means that proportionally, the person working on the oil rig is paying more than the person who is earning twice or three times their salary. I'd rather see us do maybe a lower percentage with no cap. I just don't understand the logic of letting higher earners pay less. I just don't get that. Second one, big piece of policy that I work on every day is healthcare. Our state pays $2 billion a year for healthcare between public employees, what we pay for teachers, what we pay for retirees, and what we pay for Medicaid. That's a huge part of our spending. And we also have the highest cost of healthcare in the country, and we don't necessarily have the highest health outcomes. So what kind of value are we getting for that investment? And there's many things we could do to improve the value from that investment and to spread that investment so that many more people can access affordable healthcare. And I believe that we could actually spread that so far that we could almost say every Alaskan can access affordable healthcare. I think if we made that our goal, we would allow businesses then to not be spending, I mean, healthcare is the second largest part of my budget every year. So, and if I didn't provide it, I wouldn't have any employees. So it's not really an option for me not to do it. But this cost of it is far beyond the value that we get from it, and that's only going up. So I think those two things would set us on a good path to having a stable economic base and helping Alaskans provide for their quality of life.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been listening to an event titled Choosing Our Future, Alaska's Fiscal Options, that was hosted by Alaska Common Ground on October 5th. This panel was comprised of Andrew Helcrow, Charles Woolforth, Rick Helford, Kathy Wasserman, and Thea Agnew-Bembin. Let's return to moderator John Parsi.
One of the questions that we've been asked is there a way to use the permanent fund dividend or money from an instituted income tax to incentivize new industry?
The problem is Alaska does not have kind of the sufficient revenue streams to provide revenue options for tax credits. For instance, we visited, in my day job, we visited Oklahoma City. And what Oklahoma City did was they passed a special 1% sales tax that was going to be used for to stimulate business, capital improvement projects. So they had a revenue stream that could be used for that. It's tough to see a scenario where you're going to use revenues from an income tax or a sales tax created by the state to fund anything other than what the state really isn't providing very well today. I mean, I can't see a point in time where you're going to generate enough of an income tax, use enough permanent fund earnings to have sufficient revenue to really have an effective community development or economic development program. I mean, I think we ought to pay for what we need now. And I think just simply having better roads, better schools, better public safety, that's going to drive economic development. And to be honest with you, that's government's role. to keep the streets safe, to keep them plowed, to keep them safe, you know, to keep good schools. So that's government's role. And if government's doing the role correctly and you have a stable economy, economic development will come.
Well, I don't disagree with anything Andrew said, except that I would say we're already using the permanent fund as a huge business incentivizer by putting $650, $700 million into the economy in the middle of October, which everybody spends, right? That's a tremendous economic boost, which if you got rid of it would be sort of the most economically painful way that you could cut the budget. The ICER figures that I think Musin just barely alluded to in his talk is, you know, that money that goes to everyone, including low-income people, is spent right away. And so getting rid of that has a really severe impact on jobs if you do that. So I think we are using that money. I think we should continue to use it at the level we're at for that, you know, economic purpose and that social purpose that it's being used for.
Why would you take the most regressive course possible to get the money to try and push the high side of the economic spectrum? And we've already taken out of the economy $1 billion, $1.2 billion in the last 2 years, and we've seen the effect. It spread the recession into the whole economy, not just in the oil patch. It's now everywhere in our economy, and it's in every community across the state. That would seem like the last place you'd want to go. I mean, I believe that there are some targeted ways that you can do things, but that's not the source of money. The activity that we've gone through has been the most regressive we possibly could have done, and it targeted only Alaskans. Nobody outside of the state contributes a penny to the solution we've found so far.
I agree. A lot of the municipalities certainly cannot afford to give any sort of cuts on property tax or sales tax to any business that should come in. And without a capital budget of any sort, we don't have good roads, our schools are suffering, our hospitals are suffering, much of our infrastructure is suffering, and that is certainly not a way to attract businesses. We have to up our capital budget and look at how we build the state to attract these people.
I think the only thing I would add to that is that when I've listened to Alaskans around the state giving testimony, took away from that is that a lot of people think that when we cut government, somehow we are not impacting our economy. So when we lose well-paid jobs that have health insurance that then pay for health care, all of those people, all of those dollars are continuing to circulate in our economy. And when we cut the capital budget, which I think that's actually a great example, when I look at the Lusac Library and I think, how did we get that building with the outdoor staircase and the whole deal? Or how did we get Diamond High with the outdoor hallways? Well, when I was a kid, I'm sure there were some good architecture firms, but they were not the ones designing our public facilities. Man, look today, we've got some killer architectural firms because they've been allowed to develop and grow here because we've made so much investment. So I think we have to really think about how does our investment kind of spark the private sector? Because, I mean, my business, we have lots of different clients, but, you know, there's public money in a lot of our contracts. And, you know, thank God there is, or else we wouldn't have 20 people working there. So, I mean, there's private money too, but it all goes around. So I think we got to remember that.
Perfect. So now we're gonna give a chance for the panelists to ask each other questions. So Rick, since you've got the microphone, do you want to start?
I would ask any member of the panel for ideas on how to reconnect the people to their permanent fund. I mean, that was the essential element of the system that we designed close to 40 years ago as a dedicated fund. And now it looks like it takes a constitutional amendment to do that, because the other provisions, the inflation proofing, the management structure, and all the things that protect the permanent fund into the long-term future are enforced by the direct impact on the dividend. Now the dividend has become an appropriation. Is it high in even-numbered years and low in odd-numbered years, or how does it work? So I would ask for suggestions as how to reconnect the people of Alaska to their permanent fund, because they have been the defenders through every other effort to use permanent fund income. And it doesn't mean that there's not permanent fund income that can be used in the governmental system. The permanent fund is a huge resource for our future. I agree with that.
Well, thank you for that question, Rick, though you didn't direct it to me. I think that Rick and I disagree a little bit on how much the permanent fund dividend should be, but I think we both agree that there should be a permanent fund dividend. I think a great way to reconnect people would be to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot to enshrine the permanent fund dividend in the Constitution. If it were me, I would put it at the level that we have it now of $1,100 plus an inflation adjustment so that it would continue to go up. And then I think what that would do would be it would take that element, take that political football off the field and force the legislature to grapple with the rest of the problem. What I'm really afraid of is that through continued inaction, the dividend just being an appropriation is going to continue to shrink. It's always going to be easier to take something away from everyone than to take something away from your well-heeled campaign contributors who would pay a graduated income tax. And so the other thing that I think would happen is we get some buy-in for this whole thing, right? I mean, I think if we had a statewide election campaign where people had to vote on a solution, I think maybe we might move past this spot we're at now where we're in a circular firing squad and we can't really come up with anything and gel around anything. So I think it would be, I think we'd get some, I think we'd make a move forward. And the other final thing is I think it would provide some political cover to those legislators who actually have shown some courage, because it would be saying, okay, we put it to the voters, now we're going to vote on something that is probably the most significant part of a solution. And it's okay if you stuck your neck out, because it's going to everyone. So that would be my way to get buy-in.
Okay, so full disclosure, for those of you who know me, I'm publicly stating tonight, I will never, ever, ever seek public office. So I'm going to speak my mind, all right? And my wife is here, and I've already promised her that, so this isn't a surprise. I have been involved in this conversation, as I said, for 18 years. And there has been one consistently horrible idea for 18 years, enshrining the dividend in the Constitution. That is the absolute, and I'm sorry, Charles, this is 18 years of frustration. That is the absolute worst idea. Ladies and gentlemen, we live in a state that balances its budget on the fluctuating price of a non-renewable resource. I mean, my God, why don't we just take it to Vegas and throw it on the craps tables? This is silly. It's a structural problem. Look, there are people in this room that I see right now that have known, that know Jay Hammond far better than I do, and for far longer. But Jay Hammond made one thing very, very clear. He was very disappointed that the whole reason, not the whole reason, but an important reason of the dividend was to make people owners of government. Was, as he called them, to be the watchdogs of what Juno spent. And he was so dismayed because people didn't give a damn about what was going on in Juno as far as being spent, so long as they walked to the mailbox every October and got the check. Now, you can totally debate how the fund should be used, but you have to use it. And it's good because it's Wall Street money. And that's less money that we're recirculating in an already very limited economy for any other number of reasons. Again, four things. You need a broad-based tax. People have to start paying for the services that they receive. Do you realize the only tax you pay is 10 cents per gallon, gas tax? And it hasn't been raised since John F. Kennedy was in the White House? I mean, ladies and gentlemen, I've loved the dividend for 30 years. But we can't do it anymore. Seriously, it's got to be reworked.
You've got to pay. We need to use permanent fund earnings. We need to manage government better, and we need to work like hell to responsibly develop our resources. That's it. You don't need to worry about enshrining the dividend, because all you're going to do is make people care less about what's going on in Juneau, because they're going to be constantly constitutionally guaranteed. They're going to get a check every year. Tie that. You want to make people owners of government? Tie it to the performance of government. That way, after 16 years of whistling past the graveyard, you wouldn't have these same people that drove us to this edge of this cliff running for governor. Maybe you get some people with some new ideas and some guts. Maybe you get people with backbones instead of wishbones. We're not investing in ourselves. We're not building any new roads. We're not building any infrastructure. Cost shifts to communities are raising local property taxes, as well as local property taxes, property taxpayers' anger over crime. I mean, you've got a Department of Law and a corrections. I mean, their budgets are at levels that were 6 years ago. I mean, this is not rocket science. And I always love those people who say, you know what, Andrew? You should run government like a business. And the first thing I say is, okay, let's stop paying out a $1,000 bonus per, or a dividend per person when the company's losing money. Seriously, I know how important the dividend is, but it's part of the equation. The debate needs to be focused. What broad-based tax, sales tax or income tax? Both have pros and cons. You want to throw a sales tax on? What does that do to local communities? Income tax? What percentage comes from Alaskans versus out-of-staters? These are the discussions you guys need to be having in Juneau. Not, we don't need a tax, we're going to just, you know, find a pot of gold in the woods 5 years from now. Sorry.
I would approach the question about the dividend from just a slightly different angle, which is that the dividend, just like the notion that we need to have a cap on an income tax, those are just kind of codes for us not wanting to talk about the disparity in income that we have in Alaska. And I think what we need to talk about really is, how do we want to make those investments? How do we want to ensure that all Alaskans have the ability to take care of their families' basic needs? And I think when you look at it from that perspective, you have to acknowledge that some Alaskans are going to need different types and, in some cases, more supports than others. And that's kind of how it goes. I mean, if the person sitting next to me needs to wear glasses so that we can both watch the movie, and I say, I'm sorry, you can't have glasses because I don't need glasses to watch this movie, that doesn't make any sense. We wouldn't do that. So I think we have to acknowledge, especially in a state like ours, where it's important to recognize that we're living in a post-colonial place here. In some ways, we still are sort of like a colony. And we have all of the impacts of the trauma and the just of our history. And there's a lot of wonderful things in our history, and there's lots of really traumatic things in our history. And so we just have to acknowledge that that's the place we live in. Some people are going to need more help than others. And in some cases, a dividend, if you have four kids, man, and you and your partner, you know, having $6,000 come through the door, that's pretty awesome. And you're right, you're going to spend that right here in Alaska because you need it for basic goods. So there's a real value to that. I think there's also a danger, as we've said, that just makes us so we never want to spend it on anything, which clearly we're at a point where that's not possible. So I think even though it does seem a little ridiculous to me that we would give a dividend and then when we would tax it back, on the other hand, it's not that much more ridiculous to me than that we would cap a tax so that I actually did the math, so that somebody who earns $1 million a year, if their tax is really only 0.2%, this is the governor's proposal, whereas, you know, for someone who earns $25,000 a year, it's 1.5%. So it's like multiples more. I think we have to look at it. We need to look at it from an equity point of view, not so much do we need a dividend or not.
You know, the permanent fund system really embodies the legacies that go back to the founders of the Constitution and start with Wally Hickel and the owner state and go through Hammond and individualizing that ownership, take up the expertise of the Alaska's premier banker and the way it was put together in Elmer Rasmussen. Those legacies are the system that you have. And that system has worked to be an example used by the World Bank as the best way for any area with high resource values to deal with their common good. And part of the reason that it was such a target is because Hammond's last interest was to try to get it adopted in part of the Iraqi Constitution. He went to the State Department, he was getting some traction until the resource industries thought, wait a minute, people are going to understand that these are their resources. They are not going to like that. And they worked against it, they stopped it, and they made sure it didn't go anywhere. But the world is full of countries that are rich in resources, as we are, and poor in people. The permanent fund system has worked as a worldwide example. And for us to think that we should create our solutions taking the most from the least to give to the top of the economic spectrum, this is economic warfare at its worst. And that's what, I mean, I don't know the absolute solution, but I believe that going to the people of Alaska, giving them all the information about what's at stake, what our resources are, financial and otherwise, and taking them into the solution, whether it's a third, a third, a third, or whatever it is, put it in the Constitution so people can vote on it, so they can reestablish the connection that every expert that's analyzed the permanent fund says is the reason the permanent fund is alive today. It was attacked by virtually every set of elitist leaders from the Hammond time until now. It has been defended by the permanent fund effectively, and some linkage needs to go back. And we can argue about what the linkage will be, but it needs to be linked or it will not survive.
All right, and I've got, before we get back to questions from the panel, to the panel, I've got a couple of questions that actually deal with one of the issues that's been raised. How do you feel about placing a cap on the permanent fund dividend for people above a certain wage threshold or a means test for determining when certain people will no longer reserve the permanent fund dividend versus people who may need it more than those with those higher salaries? Thoughts?
The problem with a cap is it takes away the linkage that protects the investment structure and everything else. It wasn't just that Hammond wanted to see a dividend. It was people like Elmer that wanted to see a management structure that carried the fund forward. If we had done as was stated 18 years ago and changed the system when it was proposed, the fund would be worth about two-thirds of what it was today. If we'd done that when Sheffield proposed it right after Hammond was gone, it would be worth nothing. The connection is the reason that people have been active in defending the fund. That connection may need to be less than half of the income. It may need to be something else, but that's what the debate should be.
I think,
and it should draw the people in, not out.
I think I want to restate it because I don't think I made it as clear as possible. What if it was based off of personal wages? So someone who makes, let's say, $1 million a year no longer qualifies for the permanent fund dividend. And people who make less than $1 million, you still get your paycheck.
Hammond's answer was just tax it back.
And I want to, you know, just to throw some numbers out there. So every $1,000 of the permanent fund costs about $650 million. If you figure that we're going to use earnings reserve to cover the deficit, which we are, there's no other way to cover it eventually, and you figure a percent of market value, about $600 million is what the real gap is. So this number of, you know, $3 billion, you already know you're going to spend, say, $2.4 billion from earnings reserve on an ongoing basis. So you're left with, you know, take some money out for the dividend we have now. You've got about $600 million gap. The ways you could get rid of that, you could do a broad-based tax for $600 million. You could get rid of the rest of the dividend. That would balance it. You could, you know, potentially find some other way to do it. The idea of means testing the dividend, I think, turns it basically into a welfare payment, which I don't think was what it was originally intended. And it also takes people off the hook at the sort of the top end, right? Because I don't know how you're going to do this thing. So what makes much more sense is to do an income, give a, you know, if you do a $1,000, $1,100 dividend and do the rest with an income tax, then it seems like a reasonable compromise, right? Because you've got this base income of $1,000 that sort of hits everybody equally and does the benefits of protecting the permanent fund and creating constituency. And then you've also got a true graduated a tax where people are paying according to their means. And that seems like a, you know, we're never going to come up with a solution that's like perfect, right? Because this is a group decision problem. We've got all these people. We're never all going to agree. Everybody's going to have to give in and say, okay, well, that sounds good enough. I guess I can live with it, you know? And sort of that's been the problem so far. And so something like that seems like, you know, or maybe you take a little from the oil industry, maybe you have a slightly smaller tax. I mean, there's got to be a way to put these pieces together.
So I think we're a little bit trapped right now. And I that's okay, because we are sort of as a state. But I guess I just want to encourage us to think, of course, nobody likes to pay taxes. We all pay taxes. I mean, if you know, federal taxes and other things. Nobody enjoys doing it. But I guess I just want to know, would we prefer to remain stuck and, like folks are saying here, you know, eventually just not have a dividend because we've spent all the money. We don't have any other choices. So that seems like a dead end. Do we want to stay there? Or do we want to say, okay, look, you know, the math actually does work out if we keep the dividend at a certain level, use some of the permanent fund, do a broad-based tax. Math works out. Guess what? We can carry on. And if that was something we committed to, we could then say, okay, we're not spending the amount of money that we did when I was growing up, but we're doing all right. We're taking care of basics. Now let's focus on how do we really spend our money wisely, which I have to say, there's so many instances of the fact that we had so much money, we didn't bother to spend it wisely. We just spent it, right? So now we're like, holy cow, we really have to ratchet back here. And I'm just going to bring it up because it hasn't come up again. But healthcare, hello. This is like something that we're spending an enormous amount of money on. I mean, enormous. We are spending so much money on it, and yet we still have people uninsured. We still have services that can't be accessed because people don't have the money to pay for them. We still have people going to the emergency room, you know, on a routine basis. We still have people with chronic health issues that can't get care. We still have people coming out of corrections and ending right back in because they can't get behavioral health care to take care of their addictions and mental health issues. So couldn't we focus first on getting over this hump, biting the bullet, deciding we're going to take the medicine, and then let's fix this place, man, because it's cool. It's a great place to live. It's a great place to grow up. And it doesn't need to suck. It doesn't need to have unsafe communities and everyone feeling real grumpy. It can feel like a great place, but we do need to take care of business. So I don't know. I'm ready. I'm ready to do it. Who doesn't want to do that? I don't get it.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been hearing about Alaska's fiscal options as the state faces budget issues. This program was heavily edited from the full two-hour event. If you're interested in hearing the complete audio, including a second panel discussion featuring current legislators from around the area, you can find that at our website, alaskapublic.org, and just look for Addressing Alaskans. I'm your host and producer for today's program, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.